Hi, Aaron. Give me one sec. I'm just Googling something.
What are you Googling?
I want to know how the internet defines the talent pipeline. Okay, here we go. A talent pipeline is, quote, a pool of candidates who are ready to fill a position. These can be employees who are prospects for advancement or external candidates partially or fully pre-qualified to take an opening, end quote. And that's according to this SearchHR software website.
Well, that sounds like a topic right up our alley.
Indeed. We can't talk about innovation without talking about talent. And as we just heard, the pipeline is a reflection of whether your organization has the skills and experience to grow and thrive.
So that's what we're digging into today. In particular, whether challenges to diversify our workforce from the board on down are due to a pipeline problem. Is it an issue of supply or demand? We're going to discuss in depth. I'm Erin Essenmacher.
And I'm Ashley Marchand-Orme.
And this is Future Fluency, a podcast by the National Association of Corporate Directors, where we explore the changing face of America through the lens of innovation and culture and their impact on business. And for this episode, we are digging deep into what the pipeline of talent for corporate leadership looks like now and in the future.
That's right, Erin. And we've got some really smart folks who are going to help us understand the myths and the truth around the talent pipeline.
It turns out that the question of how the pipeline figures into diversity in the workplace can be complicated. This issue is multifaceted, and so we'll look at it from a few of those angles, including talent coming into corporations, the way that talent develops and gets translated to leadership, and how that leadership makes it into the boardroom. As we'll hear, it's both a question of training and a question of rethinking who belongs at the literal and metaphorical table.
We'll end up in the boardroom, but we're going to start at the beginning. In particular, how we think about equipping future generations of leaders with the skills they need to be competitive. We see this perhaps most visibly in the efforts of groups like Black Girls Code and Code Bar to help girls and people of color build skills that will make them competitive in the 21st century economy. Their efforts are driven in large part by a desire to address the well-documented lack of diversity in places like Silicon Valley.
Hope Tates, who our listeners first met in episode one, has a great perspective on this. In addition to her work as an investor and as a corporate board member, she also recently served on the board of Girls Who Code. Here she is describing their work.
Girls Who Code started out as a summer immersion program to teach high school girls computer science. The number of women that major or minor in computer science is under 20%. The number has actually declined. It is a real issue in terms of the pipeline. And it started out as a summer immersion program. It has moved into clubs and other types of programs and shorter form. But my desire really was to get more women into STEM. I joke, I was that girl. I was that girl who loved math and science. I had placed out of physics. I was fortunate enough to find finance, but it would have been great if I had learned to code. I've subsequently gone back and learned JavaScript because I thought I had to in this new age. But it is my desire to educate girls in a pathway to where jobs are going to be, to where tomorrow's jobs are going to be.
Groups like Girls Who Code are doing a great job of feeding the talent pipeline at the front end. As we get into the management ranks and eventually the board, the answer looks different, and it links closely with innovation. Skip Spriggs is a former human resource executive for companies like UPS, Levi Strauss, and the Home Depot, and he now serves as CEO of the Executive Leadership Council, an organization committed to advancing the role and contributions of Black executives and preparing them for corporate leadership. He talked about how the pipeline problem manifests in the corporate ranks, and like much of what we discuss across the podcast, the problem and the solution tie closely to culture.
Every CEO, every C-suite executive should always put the best skilled person in the role. That being said, each business, it's incumbent upon them to make sure as they're developing talent, they've got a broad array of talent. And so when it comes time to make a selection, you're not making a selection from a pool of one. You're making a qualified selection of people that are diverse in background, diverse in gender, diverse in ethnicity. And the greater that diversity is in that pool, the more likely it is you end up with a more diverse leadership team. People of color, in particular Blacks, do not progress through the corporate ranks as well as others. Just by the nature of the Fortune 500, there's only three African-American CEOs in the Fortune 500. 3 or 4 years ago, that number was six. And so, and the pipeline's not very encouraging. And so even though corporations are talking about diversity and inclusion, I think that the better conversation is diversity and inclusion disaggregated. You have to talk about each affected group and what kind of progress each group's making. Because women and people of color oftentimes don't have that same opportunity. They don't have the same mentorship circle. They don't have the same sponsorship circle. They don't have the same opportunity for exposure, which is why the ELC actually exists. The purpose of the ELC is to put more Blacks on boards, more Blacks as CEOs, and more Blacks in C-suites, with the understanding that that's a business imperative. But we try to create environments where senior level executives get that sponsorship, they get that advocacy, and they get skills enhancement to bridge that gap so they can be competitive.
As Skip said, groups like ELC exist specifically to address the pipeline problem at various phases of leadership and development, and to ensure that up-and-coming leaders get the exposure and mentorship they need to help fill the pipeline. But success also requires the commitment of other business partners to tap that well of talent, especially the chief human resource officer. Here's Skip again.
You still see organizations talk about succession planning. And organizations will do things and say, you know what, in order for this individual to get promoted, they need some international experience. And so they send somebody overseas to get international experience. Or they may say, you need a staff role. Or if you're in a staff function, you need a P&L role. I think all those things are really important around succession planning. But I think you also have to put an extra lens around gender and diversity. So when you look at the people in your pipeline, you need to look at ethnicity, you need to look at gender, and then you need to look at what is the universal gap that entire group has to get to the C-suite. And that everybody should have the same opportunity from a development plan perspective to get to that next level. And if you have a group that you're trying to develop and it all looks the same, you need to figure out what is the problem. Do we have hiring practice problems? Do we have development practice problems? Do we have succession problems? Certainly, it's the role of the senior leadership team. But generally, the person that's helped driving that is your chief human resources officer. They're responsible for succession planning. They're responsible for leadership development. They're responsible for culture. And that needs to be driven by the HR function with the leadership team. But you definitely have a problem if the next level isn't representative of the workforce that you have, the community that you live in, or the customers that you serve.
Skip also identified one other group that is a key partner in determining whether or not your pipeline is truly diverse: search firms.
Most C-suite jobs get put out to search with one of the big search firms, all the good ones: Russell Reynolds, Korn Ferry, Heidrick & Struggles, Egon Zehnder, Spencer Stuart. All of the big ones get the really big searches. If I were a CEO, I would say to those search firms, do not send me a slate of candidates without sending me a qualified, diverse slate of candidates, which includes gender and ethnicity. And if the search firm says I can't do that, the analogy I would give would be being an owner of a football team and having a quarterback that can't throw the ball. That's the job of a search firm. There are diverse candidates that are qualified to do every senior level job that there is. Do you give them a chance?
Skip makes a great point about the pipeline being not a reflection of the talent pool, but of the willingness of the company to prioritize nurturing diverse talent and then promoting those leaders. Between that and his discussion of the critical role that search firms play in advancing diversity in leadership, Ashley, I couldn't help but think of your conversation with Beth Stewart.
Yes, as the founder and CEO of TruStar Corporate Board Services, Beth has a great perspective here. I'll let her describe her background and work.
I started this company called TruStar about 6 years ago, and I started it because I actually had been a corporate director for 20 years before I started TruStar, and before that I had been an investment banker, and the combination of both of those things led me to the realization that a lot of people were talking about getting women on boards, but there was actually very little that was happening. So I thought with the investment banking experience and the inside the boardroom experience that I would form this company, and we would specialize in getting women on boards. So we present all female slates, and we have never had a failed search. We do this all across the country and all different industries.
Beth's focus makes sense when you consider the fact that while the percentage of women on boards has improved slightly over the past 2 years, it's still sluggish. One-fifth of the Russell 3000 companies still don't have a single woman on their boards. And the numbers are even worse for non-white directors. Not a great strategy when you consider the importance of linking board composition with long-term growth, of ensuring that those around the table have the perspective and skills to help the company navigate the challenges of a rapidly changing business environment.
Tell us a little bit more also about why boards decide that they want to come to you and add a woman to seek you out.
You know, I think that, and this has been, you know, what's happened in the last year is kind of incredible with all the different ways. There's so much pressure about equality for women and, you know, hashtag Me Too and hashtag Time's Up. And but before all of that happened, there were two other forces. One was just this general sense that, you know, we want to have women in executive management positions. We want to have women in the pipeline, and we want to have women at the board level. Then we had March 7th, 2017, when the institutional investor community, who had been out there, really took a much more aggressive position on this. And March 7th is the day that State Street Global Advisors came out and said, we're going to vote against chairs of nominating governance who don't add women to their boards. And they placed the fearless girl in front of the raging bull on Wall Street. And then numerous other institutional investors have joined that, although many have been talking about it before, numerous others have joined on that specific bandwagon of, we're going to vote against chairs of nominating governance. So this has made a dramatic difference. At least in our business, it hasn't yet made a dramatic difference in the numbers, but I do believe there is a heightened focus on this. And what we think at TruStar is, the important thing is, it's not about adding women. It's about adding qualified people who will refresh these boards who coincidentally are women.
You used the word pipeline just now, and you know, I've heard concerns that maybe sound something like this. Gosh, I wish I could get more women in my boardroom and in the C-suite, but it's hard to find women with the financial background or the skill set that we're looking for. You know, we've got to fix our talent pipeline so we can fix this issue down the line. So concerns like that, are those legitimate? What's your take on that argument?
I think there are many, many people who realize how not legitimate those concerns are. I thought it would be helpful if I put some numbers to this for you. This is very back of the envelope. We are not a research organization. But here's a way to think about the magnitude of the issue. So let's say there's 500 companies in the Fortune 500, and that there's approximately 10 seats per company. That's 5,000 board seats. Of those 5,000 board seats, if you wanted to get to parity, which I don't see why you wouldn't want to get to parity if you have qualified people, that means you need 2,500 women. We are currently at 21% women on Fortune 500 boards. So that means we have 1,050 women on the boards already. So now that would say, if you just do by the way, all I can do is arithmetic. So this is all simple arithmetic. If you subtract 1,050 from 2,500, you get 1,450 women. If you say, especially for women who are recently retired, they're going to go on more than one board. So let's just say on average, they're on two boards. It really says you need 725 women in the United States of America. We don't have 725 women. If you look at corporate America, the C-suite, and for the larger companies, one level below the C-suite, if you look at the military, where there's fantastic female candidates, that is generals at the general level. If you look at audit partners, if you look at consulting partners, if you look at some investment banking partners, you mean to tell me in all of the United States, we don't have 725 women? It's almost ridiculous. Now, to further put that in context, we've done 70 searches. And almost every time we do a search, we present, let's say, just to make the math easy for me, let's say we have proposed 10 candidates. And by the way, we only propose candidates we know that have been fully vetted. So it's not an exercise of just pushing candidates out of a database. So let's say that we've done 70 searches times 10 candidates. Some of them have gotten on boards. So that leaves the rest that we thought were terrific to begin with, that aren't on boards. And so you come down to, you know, something around, you know, 650 candidates that we've already vetted, that we know, that met the qualifications for a whole host of different kinds of companies and different kinds of skill sets versus this 725 women. That we're just one search firm.
Beth makes a compelling case for a strong pipeline of women who are board ready, but that's only part of the equation when we think about board diversity, which is why I love the work that Andrea Hoffman is doing here.
Like Beth, Andrea formed a company that helps organizations be more deliberate about identifying diverse talent and using it to create a strategic advantage. It was born out of a need to connect the dots between diversity and innovation. Here's Andrea.
I was sitting in a meeting in corporate, working on an iconic luxury brand that was shifting the demographic towards a young, more diverse audience. And I was part of a team that led their multicultural strategy. So I started as a target marketing strategist. And then within that, you have to do, you know, business development, deal making, right, if you want to activate those ideas and opportunities. And I was sitting in a meeting and they had hired me specifically to find them new markets and new business opportunities. And when I presented my research, which was lengthy and rigorous, they didn't really seem to be as excited as they should have been if they really wanted a competitive advantage. These were untapped markets, they had spending power, and what better opportunity? And when I saw all of these politics get in the way and that they really didn't get it, I decided that I was going to leave and do my own thing.
That thing became Culture Shift Labs, all centered around bringing together a robust network of diverse leaders, both in terms of race and ethnicity and in terms of the technology and innovation perspectives they can bring to a boardroom. She talks about how they use Culture Shift Weekends to bolster strong networks of diverse talent and to widen the lens for executives to discover talent that may not be on their radar.
People go to their normal networks. If you're a white person in a white neighborhood with white friends at the white golf course with the white vacations, that's what you know. And if you're just grabbing talent, that's the low-hanging fruit. Culture Shift Labs has Culture Shifting Weekends. It brings together between 250 and 300 predominantly Black, some Latinx leaders, and oftentimes they don't know each other. And when we bring decision makers in that may be in other parts of the company that don't necessarily fit that profile, as I was saying earlier, they get to see firsthand that they're probably missing an opportunity. And when they start to see that everybody knows one another and you go, you walk 5 feet and you meet the inventor of the Super Soaker, Lonnie Johnson, who is a Black man. Well, you take another couple of feet and you meet Sam Bright, who runs a multi-billion-dollar division of eBay, and he's a millennial Black young man. You take another step, another couple of feet, and you meet Tyson Clark, who is a partner at Google Ventures. Another couple of feet, and you meet Shelley Archambault, who's the CEO of MetricStream. Imagine a room that you've never been in, don't really know exists, or maybe you think it might, but you've never been in it, and we throw you in there, and it changes everything for you.
Whoa, that is one powerful room. And it really underscores Skip's point about creating environments where emerging leaders can shine. So we know the talent is there. It's a matter of finding and nurturing it. And the myth of the pipeline problem becomes even more dubious when you consider changing notions of who makes a good director. Beth referenced those with an audit, banking, consulting, or military background. At the same time, we're seeing boards look to those with skill sets that reflect the disruption in the business environment and the changing nature of industry and competition. I'm thinking about those with experience globally or in social media, HR, and digital transformation. This widens the pipeline even further by expanding the pool of director candidates.
That's such a great point, and the numbers reflect this. 33% of those appointed to the boards of S&P 500 companies in 2018 were first-time directors, according to a 2018 Spencer Stuart Board Index. This is, in large part, a reflection of boards recognizing the need to rethink who makes a good director.
Right. If the board's role is to oversee strategy and risk and to help ensure long-term value creation for the enterprise, then ensuring you have a board who can take that long view, especially in a dynamic business environment, is key. Consider this. Of the companies who made up the Fortune 500 in 1955, only about 10% are still there. That's according to a 2018 report by the American Enterprise Institute. A 2016 report by Innosight estimates that about half of today's S&P 500 companies will be replaced over the next 10 years as a result of volatility in the business environment.
It's all part of the creative destruction that fuels the economy. And for those companies who don't want to go the way of the nearly 90% who have slipped out of the Fortune 500, it requires having a board that can help the company think long term.
And that means reimagining the profile of who should have a seat at the table. Traditionally, boards have looked to the C-suite, and particularly CEOs and CFOs, to fill board seats. But many companies are starting to recognize that model may no longer be sufficient. It's like that old saying, you can't solve tomorrow's problems with yesterday's tools. And I would argue that the mindset that underpins those old tools can point to other red flags around strategy and risk. If you're not thinking differently about who should be sitting around the board table, you're likely not thinking differently about key strategic questions like what business are we in and who is our competition? Or going back to the story that Andrea shared that was the springboard for her work, who is our customer? Hope Tates and Skip Spriggs each captured perfectly how outdated models of who makes a good director can hurt a board's ability to bring in the right talent. We'll hear first from Skip and then Hope.
Your board composition needs to be as diverse as the leadership team. And over history, boards have been historically made up of former CEOs, and in some instances, CFOs. And I don't know exactly what the percentage is, but it's disproportionately CEOs. Well, guess what? Today in the Fortune 500, there's only three black CEOs and just a handful of women. So if your board is only going to be made up of CEOs, it's a self-perpetuating problem because you've got 500, you've got 450 white men. And so board lead directors and board chairs, I think they have to be more selective. And again, I have to go back to this thing around whose role is it in an organization to help drive culture? So who at the board level is asking the questions around culture, around succession planning, around leadership development? Who has that skill set?
There was an attempt to always find a current C-suite sitting woman for a board. Quite frankly, a current C-suite sitting woman doesn't have that much space for other boards. And especially as we evolve into new age companies, we should look a rung below, and the up and coming woman, the what I call the unsungs, the ones you don't know, because those are the ones that actually know what's going on. And we've got to be preparing them in a way they are huge assets into the boardroom. The other issue, and this goes back to the Girls Who Code discussion, is women, girls drop out of math and science at the age of approximately 7. They are deciding not to accelerate in math and sciences and versus English and history. They are playing with Barbies. They are not playing with video games. They are not moving forward. We need, and one of the reasons that I went on the consortium for computer science for all is we need to bring that computer science in at a younger age so we don't get girls to drop out, so that we get them engaged in math and science, so that we get it cool to be in math and science, and so that we pull those girls up through. And then maybe they're not in the C-suite yet, but they're going to be great board members. So we need to think about starting young, pulling them through, training them through, and then we can, then there's going to be an unbelievable pool. So re-educating the headhunters to some of the people they don't know. Unfortunately, they don't know some of the more junior people outside of the C-suite. How do we bring those people into the fold? And then how do we start to talk to them about getting educated about what it means to be on a board.
I think that's such a great point. And even when you think of the role of the board, even before we get to the level of board readiness, if you just look at sort of the board's role in talent oversight and competitiveness and long-term value creation and sustainability, and then you sort of map that to where we are with the unemployment rate, to all of what we're hearing in terms of readiness for the jobs of the future and how to stay competitive when we think about things like AI and machine learning and data, you start to see sort of this convergence of where this pipeline diversity issue really starts to converge with a real potential corporate risk in terms of a talent pool.
100%. First of all, I like to say in the boardroom, boards talk about the competition they know. It's the competition you don't know, right? What is the technology? What is being disintermediated around you? There is a young generation of entrepreneurs that are disrupting 24/7. They are tremendously interesting assets because they're the ones that are going to tell you, if you're in a hotel industry, what Airbnb means to them. They're purchasing in a different way. They understand AI, machine learning. They understand all of the digital revolution that is going on that is disrupting every single boardroom.
Okay, so it sounds like supply isn't the issue.
Right. It's really about fostering the opportunity and understanding that creating those openings is not just about advancing diversity. It's about staying competitive. Here's Beth again.
I mean, we could do this. The last problem we have is a lack of supply of talented women. It's all on what we call the demand side. It's all about getting companies to create openings.
What is keeping companies then from actually diversifying the board?
It is a complex question. It's a very delicate question. I don't want to offend anybody, but I am going to be fairly straightforward about what the problem is. The reason there aren't more women on boards is because there are not more openings. And if you and just here are some more numbers for you. The rollover in the last 3 or 4 years has been between 6% and 8%. This is rollover on the Fortune 500. If you expanded it to the Fortune 1000 or the Russell 3000, it's only worse. But the numbers are tracked on the Fortune 500. So it's 6% to 8%. So the real question is, and what I would say to institutional investors are, you've done this incredible thing of actually saying and then following through on no votes for chairs of nominating and governance that don't create diverse boards. I think the next thing under that broad umbrella is to start really pressing on boards will say, we don't have any turnover, we don't have any openings. Well, why don't you have any openings? Why? I mean, you know, have you spent as much time evaluating the individuals who automatically get renewed as you are scrutinizing the group of candidates that you want to add? And I don't think it's a secret. And if it is, I'll be the first one to say it. There isn't the scrutiny on their people are automatically renewed. That's a problem. It shouldn't happen that way.
And that brings me to another scenario. Let's say we have a company that's doing really well. Maybe investors are happy. The board is not diverse. Where does the pressure come from? What is going to actually spur that board to maybe consider adding women onto the board?
So I do hear this. We recently had a client where I actually got on the phone with the client to help them speak with one of the big state retirement funds, because he said, we're getting all this pressure and we've actually now hired TruStar. Would you help me speak to them? But so I heard this man, that was the general counsel, say, I don't know why you're putting all this pressure on us. Our performance is fantastic. And what the institutional investor said, which is true, is it's fantastic now, but doesn't mean it's always going to be fantastic. That's a decent concern. And also, you know, you think about what is it that the board is supposed to do? There's some day-to-day things or year-to-year things that a board needs to do. Hire, fire, and compensate the CEO. Assure the proper succession of the management team. Approve the strategic plan. Well, you know, those are the things they're supposed to do. And then there's crises that happen. And the board's sort of an insurance policy for when the crisis occurs. You know, something happens to the CEO, you get an activist, you get somebody trying to take over your company. You really want to have the best people at the table.
Okay, so we know we have a strong pipeline, and we know that a more diverse board in terms of perspective and types of experience is one important key to growth. So why are the board diversity stats so slow to change? The answer, in part, can be found in the board structure itself. Board turnover is low compared to other professions, a problem exacerbated by the fact that boards can be reticent to let go of, or off-board, directors who might be good guys, but may no longer be a good fit for the company's strategic direction.
Exactly. Beth and I discussed that too. I'm imagining a boardroom where you have a situation and you've got maybe directors who've sat on the board for, 15 plus years, and you know, they know everyone in the company. They know all the other directors. I imagine even the personal sort of, you know, side of that of how do I tell my fellow director that it's time for them to step off the board? Is that, again, where the strong evaluations come in?
Yes, it's I'm so sympathetic. I know how terrible this is. But here's the way I think that the boards need to think about this. As terrible as it is, as sad as you are for this person who has become your friend, as reluctant as you are to get into what could be a fight, you know, or an unpleasant situation, I think you have to say to yourself, what about the shareholders? I mean, why is it that all of those sort of emotional negatives that could happen in the boardroom are more important than what's best for the shareholders? And the notion that, well, it's not that bad is why we're going to not care about the shareholders and we're going to care about the feelings of the person who should retire. I think that's unacceptable. And I think institutional, it's not really for me to say it's unacceptable. I think institutional investors are saying more and more and more, it's unacceptable.
And since board members ultimately answer to shareholders, that investor pressure will be a key factor in shifting the conversation about the talent pipeline, both how companies invest in it and the efforts they put into seeking out diverse talent that already exists.
Right. But I also hope more boards take to heart the conversation we've had during this episode, namely that thinking of this as a check-the-box exercise is missing the larger point. Identifying new talent and diversifying the ranks should be a proactive part of a company's strategy, from the mailroom to the boardroom. Not because it's politically correct, but because it's economically necessary to stay competitive and to create a thriving organization.
Well said, Ashley, and the heart of what we'll continue to explore across this series. It's the perfect setup for our next episode, where we'll talk about discussing race and identity in the workplace.
People cannot take parts of their identity and leave them. So I think many organizations, progressive organizations, recognize that, and that's why many organizations are promoting having these conversations, whereas before they would shy away or actually discourage any kind of conversations around race.
We were listening to our people that they were hurting, they had certain experiences themselves, and they wanted to have a vehicle to have that open dialogue. We created a Day of Understanding, which was open to all of our people in offices across the country.
That's next time on Future Fluency. Thanks for listening.
For guest bios, more resources, and a link to this episode's transcript, check out the show notes or the episode page at nacdonline.org/podcast.
Future Fluency is produced and edited by Bruno Falcon, with production support from Carrie Sheehan. Special thanks to Jeanette Woods. Future Fluency is a production of the National Association of Corporate Directors. For more information on NACD or to become a member, please visit nacdonline.org.